stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with teacher, director, actor Brendan Fox, who is directing The Aliens for the second production for the FSU Oslo Conservatory for Actor Training at the Oslo. It took Brendan a pretty long time to figure out that theater was where he belonged, but once he figured it out, he never let it go. Hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. From nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap.
Welcome to The Lynn Show, and Happy New Year. I don't usually talk about New Year's resolutions because, as most of you know, New Year's resolutions are really difficult to maintain. And as the woman who wrote the book, When You Can, You Will, you might get from that I don't think one can simply make a decision, like a resolution, and then follow it, unless you really can. And what does that mean? Well, it means that I don't believe the old, if at first you don't succeed, try again. Oh, you didn't succeed. Well, then if at the second you didn't succeed, try again. Oh, you didn't. So, no. I believe that if there's something that you want to do and you haven't been able to do it, that there's a really good reason. And if you do things like make resolutions which you cannot live up to, then what happens is you feel worse about yourself and are less able to do what you wanted to do than you would have been if you allowed yourself to believe what I believe, which is that if there's something you really want to do and you haven't been able to do it, there's a really good reason. You're not lazy, you're not crazy, you're not self-destructive, you're not weak. You have a really good reason. And until you figure out what the reason is, and then see whether you can do something about the reason. Simply ordering yourself to do stuff that you think you want to do, need to do, ought to do, other people think you should do, is always going to get you into trouble. It's always going to make you feel worse about yourself, and as I said, then when you feel bad about yourself, it's even harder to do the hard things. So what can you do about that? Well, as I said, I believe that the first and most important thing you can do is to stop yelling at yourself. To believe me when I say that I believe that we human beings are not self-destructive, no matter what it looks like. We are self-protective. So I believe that you are protecting yourself in some way, even though there's a consequence to what you're not doing. Still, it's a protection. So you might try and believe me and ask yourself, in what way might I be protecting myself from by not doing this thing that I can't do, or by continuing to do this thing that I don't think I want to do? How is it that I'm protecting myself? In what way is this self-defensive? Maybe you'll just get it right off the bat. You will see something which you may have known but didn't give real credence to. Well, now it's time to give it real credence. Really think seriously about that thing that popped into your head that you are tempted to say, oh, that's silly, or that shouldn't stop me, or other people have that and they're not stopped by it. Take yourself seriously. Honor yourself. In a way, that's the whole point of the Lynn Show. The suggestion that you should be honoring yourself. Looking deeply inside yourself, not for the things you think you should be or shouldn't be, but for who you really are. And if you're having difficulty figuring this out, perhaps my book will help. It is still When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And you can get it by going up on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, thelynnshow.com. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. You can also, up on that website, click email me and ask me any questions that you have. Or even come into therapy with me as a psychotherapist. I do all of my work on the telephone, so wherever you live, I'm just at the end of a telephone. And if you click on email me and say, listen, I'd like to talk to you about maybe about therapy, I will email you back or call you if you leave me a phone number. The other things you can get up on the website, and they are many, but one of the most important things you can get on my website is you can listen to past shows. And in those shows, as in this show, I am doing a series called Anatomy of an Artist, in which I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. I do that because it is so difficult for artists to survive in our culture that when a person becomes an artist, it is who they really are. And since my show and my life and my work seems to be all about helping people discover the real them, not the pseudo them, the cover story, which is what I call it in the book, that we are mostly acting out, but what's really true about us, so you live a life that is in sync and not in opposition to who you really are. Well, when you listen to artists, you hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. You hear what congruency, to use the psychological term for it, is. And today is not an exception. Today is proving the rule. The interview I'm playing today is with Brendan Fox. And as I said in the lead-in, it took Brendan a while to recognize the theater person inside of him. Oh, yes, he could sing. Oh, yes, he was in choir. Oh, yes. But it wasn't until I I can't even remember exactly. I think it was junior high school, where he took the plunge and joined a drama class. And there he found himself and his life's work. And when you listen to Brendan, I mean, it's so clear. His passion for the theater, for directing particularly, is what we're talking about, and is so virtually jumping off the, well, it can't be off the page, right? Because we're auditory here. But you know what I mean. And so I am quiet for a lot of this interview, uncharacteristically, because it's fascinating to listen to Brendan talk about directing. And not only about directing, but he's teaching at the FSU Oslo Conservatory for Actor Training. And he's talking about the choice of plays and how the choice of plays is designed as a teaching tool. I found all of this absolutely fascinating, and not the least of which because of Brendan's passion, commitment, involvement, dare I say, obsession. Anyway, I hope that you hear it too. And, well, now I'm going to let you hear it from Brendan. Here he is, Brendan Fox. Okay, I am here with Brendan Fox. And Brendan teaches second-year students at the conservatory.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. And is also the director of the next conservatory production, which is...
The Aliens, yes.
The Aliens. I'm going to want to talk about that. But before I do, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming that you are making both at the moment and maybe always with the art of theater?
Yes.
Okay, good.
That's correct.
Okay, good. Right. So I always ask the same question, and that is, how did it start? When was the very first moment that you thought acting, stories, performance, somebody applauded, and I thought that was fun.
Yeah.
Can you remember?
Sure. I started acting in junior high school and high school, and I was actually doing a little bit of directing even then. I didn't know what I was doing, but I was doing it.
Okay, wait. If you were acting in junior high school,
yes,
then I assume that the impulse to act began before that.
Possibly. I know when I was in elementary school, I was a singer. I sang in choir, but I actually was pretty petrified to get up in front of people, and something changed, I think, when I went to a new school.
Okay, wait.
Yes.
To be honest, I want to take you way back. When did you first start to sing?
Oh, gosh. I think that was probably I was in some kind of choir in first or second grade.
Okay, so was everybody in the class in the choir?
I think, no, well, at first, but then I think it started to weed out, so I think I stayed with it, and...
So they must have thought you had a good voice.
Yes, I actually, I never was a tenor, I think I started in the soprano section, and then sometime when I came back to... when I was hit sixth or seventh grade, I went straight to bass. So I went right past that middle ground.
Okay, so did you sing at home?
A little bit. I sang in church, and my mother sang in a choir in her when she wasn't working, and that we had a lot of music in the house.
Right. So then it was a natural thing for you to sing.
Yes, I think it was. I didn't think of it as a potential calling for me, and theater was not something that. No one in my family had that in their background. We went into New York City. I was raised in Connecticut, and so it was about 45 minutes by train into New York City. And when I was in elementary school, we went in and saw some plays and some musicals.
Do you remember some of that?
Oh, yes. I remember the first two I saw were Barnum with a then-unknown Glenn Close. And we all thought, wow, she's pretty good. I think she might go somewhere. And... Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, the original production. So those had an impact.
Okay, very big musicals.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Not straight plays or anything, but very big, flashy.
Exactly. Right? Eventually I started to see straight plays. But at first I was impressed by the spectacle of it, mm-hmm, and the number of people on stage and the spectacle of something like Barnum. And mm-hmm, I think that stuck with me.
Yeah. Okay, so this is even elementary school,
yes,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So really the...
the influences are external. I mean, you know, you're seeing stuff and mm-hmm. and it's sort of turning you on. Mm-hmm. Okay, so then you're in junior high school.
Yep, and I had some friends who were performing in plays in elementary school who were also in chorus with me, but I couldn't imagine what it would be like to get up on stage at that point. So something, I kept myself distant from that until junior high, and I think I was maybe just ready to try some new things, and some of my new friends were doing it. And one of the things that I really loved about acting in plays, yes, of course, I liked the attention and the applause, but more than that, I remember thinking this pretty early on that, you know, starting in junior high and high school, it's so stratified, and there isn't a lot of interaction in the normal day-to-day between 7th, 8th, and 9th graders.
No.
But in theater, there is, because you could be in a play with these different grades and different ages, and if you... The best thing was, if you were a 7th grade boy and you made a 9th grade girl laugh, that was incredible. To even just be able to spend time. So it broke down these kind of social barriers that the school environment puts up, that it transcended that. And I felt like, you know, even in sports, there's varsity and junior varsity. But in theater, there really isn't. You can have big roles and small roles, but ultimately it takes the village to get the play up.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated by that. I think I really, maybe that to me was one of the first times I started to see the power of theater, just kind of in a weird, I wouldn't have said this word at the time, but sociologically, to see it among my friends and me, and that I could actually become friends. And if you did your lines well, and you were a hard worker, and you could not just impress the teacher who was the director, but impress your fellow students, most of whom you wouldn't normally come in contact with. So in a way, theater was this magic circle where you stepped in, and it wasn't the label that defined you. It's that, were you able to create your character well, and that was pretty much all you were defined by. And
no, you
I'll never
were
forget
asked
that
to do
exactly.
Right.
And if you excelled in that, then that's what mattered, not where you were on the social pecking order,
how old you were,
exactly.
All the stuff that kids generally evaluate each other by.
Exactly.
Right. So this is really interesting to me. What it sounds like is that you sort of accidentally found yourself in this thing, and then it captured you.
Yes.
Not like you were drawn to it, and
exactly. Well, some of my friends were that.
Going along for the ride.
Exactly. And then I was struck by the environment, and you're right, it pulled me in, and then, but then starting as early as eighth grade, it sounds like an after-school special, but the two teachers that were supposed to direct the spring show, they felt that there wasn't enough interest, at least that's what they said, so they were going to postpone it and not do a spring play. And my friends and I were appalled by this, and we said, well, if we get X number of students to come to a meeting, will we do a show? Sure, but they thought that we wouldn't do it, and we brought in a lot of kids, 40 plus or something, I don't know how many at the time, and the teachers said, that's great. Well, then they started talking about the next year's show, and we felt a little like we had some bait and switch here, that we were told that we would have a spring show. The teachers weren't up for it, and so all our friends turned to my friend Ben and me and said, well, you got us here, so why don't you guys do a show? And so we ended up kind of backing into that, and we ended up co-directing You Can't Take It With You.
Okay.
And we chose that mostly because it had
a lot of roles. Right.
Exactly. No highbrow reason.
Right. No.
We said, look at all these G-men we could put in. That's awesome. So when suddenly we could put in 18, 19, and 20 of our friends. Of course, that made it that much more difficult to do.
Yeah, you didn't know.
No, we were not thinking any more than just right in front of our faces. But it ended up being a really incredible experience, fly by the seat of our pants, but we put it together for the one and only performance, and I was really intrigued. I didn't have a light bulb and say, now I have to be a director, but it lingered with me. And then a couple of years later in high school, I directed Barefoot in the Park, and that was a little more sanctioned by the school, but they also hadn't had a student director in
years. There's no training here.
No.
They don't have a directing class.
Oh, no.
You're not reading, you know,
no.
Ilya Kazan on there, right? You're not, right?
No.
No, you're just literally intuiting.
Yes, and also, frankly, you know, I'll be honest, it's good to have, in those old play scripts of Samuel French.
Oh, they have directions.
They have the original stage directions from the 30s or 40s. So we would try that sometimes and then change it or whatever, but thank God that some stage manager back in 1935 said she crosses to the right chair. We gave us something to try. And I think I just also tried to remember or channel or think about what I had seen so far with the plays I had been in. And I would occasionally have teachers that I respected. I asked them to come and watch a little bit. But yeah, we were flying by the seat of our pants without any classroom, and it was who knows what the quality was, but it was something that I felt at home with, and I guess I was surprised that I didn't constantly feel the need to be up there with them. I still acted through high school, but I think I started to feel like it was an interesting experiment to be able to do that and be nervous in a very different way on opening night, and also deal with the fact that you have no control once the show starts.
Right.
It's out of your hands.
That's right.
And as an actor, I'd never felt that before. I thought, well, no, this is my time to shine and to do my thing. Right. But then I realized, oh, as a director, your job is over once the play starts. But I think to go back to your original question, in high school, where I felt that theater could be a calling was I acted in a production of The Winter's Tale. We were very lucky. Our school didn't have a huge arts budget, but I had two great arts teachers, and the two of them actually alternated shows that they directed, and they could not have been more different in their aesthetic and their view. And one of them did the fall comedy and the spring musical, and the other one did the two serious plays, including a Shakespeare, and we did In the Round.
Oh my goodness!
Yes.
Oh my goodness!
And so my first role was Claudius in Hamlet in junior high school, and then in high school, and then when I was in with The Winter's Tale, we did Modern Dress, and when the show finished, we were outside greeting friends and family, and my father, who had been tolerant but not enthusiastic about me potentially pursuing theater, was teared up and couldn't speak. And that was the first moment that I thought,
wow,
it's not about how I'm feeling, but to impact him in a way and to render him speechless even for a moment, someone who was resisting in a way this as a potential path for me. He never forgot it, I never forgot it, and I felt like whether it was going to be acting or directing, I just knew that this had a power that I couldn't deny.
No, my God. There isn't anything really more powerful than that.
Yeah.
And especially if he had, you know, second thoughts about it. He wasn't, you know.
Sure.
Right, that's great.
Yeah.
And I was thinking while you were talking about, you know, using the stage directions in the plays, that in a way, that was a course in directing.
Yes, it was a crash course.
Yeah, it was.
Absolutely.
You know, it did actually give you the kinds of things a director does.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it was actually.
Exactly.
Right?
And I mean, the funny thing is, on a side note, I remember this, that the day I was in high school, the day of our opening of Barefoot in the Park, I had rented from the library back in the days of VHS, a VHS tape of All That Jazz, because I saw on the back of it, oh, it's about a director. And for those who don't know the movie, it's kind of Bob Fosse's nightmare version of what it's to be a director.
It's
very
Showtime.
It's bleak.
It's very bleak
and bizarre. And I remember this is just hours before the show. And my mom comes home from work, and she finds me just sitting there with my jaw on the floor.
Right.
Says, "So, how was the movie?" I said, "I don't know if I want to ever be a director ever. This is scary. This is what directing is." And I got kind of a moment of total fear out of that movie. But it's funny that I've since gone back and watched it. And I really enjoy it, but I think that was probably a little too soon for me.
Well, I think this was much less about directing and much more about him.
Yes.
And what
yes.
he would have done that
exactly.
whatever he did.
And I realized that later, but
right.
at the time I thought, that must be what's going to happen to me.
Yeah.
Am I going to have a nervous breakdown and
right.
talk to the angel
right.
of death or something
right,
like
right,
that?
Right, right, right.
But it was, and then it was in college where I actually shifted, and I knew that directing was.
Well, hold on, you skipped a step.
Yeah.
So you had a lot of theater experience in junior high school and high school, all across the board,
yes.
Right? So then when you were getting ready to decide about college, did you know, had you decided I'm going to major in theater, or?
Yes, I was deciding, what I was deciding between was whether I wanted to major in a theater in a conservatory or a liberal arts school, and I chose Northwestern, and I just had a really great feeling about it from the get-go, and I liked that it had some aspects of a conservatory, but it was still in a broad-based mm-hmm. liberal arts setting. And ironically, one of my great mentors at Northwestern was Frank Galati.
Frank Galati, I knew that was coming.
Yes, and he actually directed me in one of the last shows I ever acted in my senior year. He adapted some short stories, and I was in it. Frank was not only a great practitioner, I saw this from being in his shows and watching his shows, but I called him the Buddha of theater. I felt that he was, he inspired me to be humble mm-hmm. and to focus on the work and to let the art speak for itself, but to just keep challenging yourself, diving deeper, take on challenging projects and find new things to explore, whether it's adaptation of literature or odd plays out there. I'm reading from Samuel Beckett to John Cheever's short stories. He at Ragtime, I felt that I loved his eclecticism too, that I could see his work in Ragtime and Grapes of Wrath and other shows, but I think he loves actors and he loves great storytellers. Mm-hmm. And that had a huge impact on me, I think, as a director going forward.
Well, you were lucky to have it.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing that I think you're implying too is that he does seem to be fairly egoless.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not about him.
Yeah.
Which is quite remarkable.
Which is not it's not the same as not having a vision. In our field, it's very easy to feel, even within the field, people can substitute a strong vision with a strong personality or ego.
Yes.
And you can have a vision for a play and get out of the way of that.
Yes.
And not make it about you.
Well, no, to make it about the thing.
Yes,
right,
rather
exactly.
than about watch me do this. And I think other folks in the field, like in any field, want to find ways to make it about them first and the play second or the work second. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that's just limited to theater. I just feel just in my experience, that's all I can speak to. But yes, I think it was, I felt very lucky all along the way. And again, one of the things I loved about Northwestern was that I was a performance studies major rather than a theater major, and they had both. And performance studies, even though they didn't have a directing major, allowed me to kind of cherry pick and create my own major, which mm-hmm. included directing classes, sociology, psychology, foreign languages. And that helped me so much moving forward as a director, because it gave me a wider net of interests and to be open to other perspectives, to look at performance in other ways, from everything from assisted living homes to kindergarten classes. That performance is not just what happens on a stage. Ritual, things like that, mm-hmm. what happens in a church. Those were all things that I just feel, in some way, consciously or not.
So they inform your work.
Inform my work,
right?
Exactly.
That you've got a rich palette from which to draw.
Yes.
That's kind of what you're saying?
And non-traditional ways of looking at theater.
Yes.
And also, just to be a more well-rounded person, I think that it helps me stay somebody active and interested in the world and not just in theater. Mm-hmm. So that everything is material. Everything is trying
grist,
to help.
Right?
Yeah, grist for the mill. And then that way I can help with actors and designers point to parallels in life or current events or a book or a painting, so that otherwise it becomes like a feedback loop, an echo chamber. All you're referencing are
what
theater
you have.
References.
Well, and what you and have,
yes.
right? Before.
Exactly.
Right.
And, you know, nothing's new. So it's I think that with that whole school experience allowed me to stay broad-minded, and
you've always been curious, and so also fairly clearly, your choice not to do a conservatory
mm-hmm.
turned out to be the right choice.
Yes, I think so, because that's one of the reasons why, because I was on the fence about acting versus directing, and I felt that if I went to a conservatory, I would have to choose leaving high school, I'm going into a conservatory for acting or for directing, but I wasn't ready at that point, and I felt that because I was still toggling between the two, I wanted to go someplace that could allow me the time and breath to do both. And that way I wouldn't look back and go, oh boy, I really fired the gun so early, and now I'm going to have to change. You know, and you can do that, it's fine, but I think, in a way, I settled on directing in a very comfortable way, and in a timeline that I didn't feel any regret. So once
I understand that. But what's so interesting to me is that I think this is not typical of 18-year-olds. I mean, generally speaking, and maybe this is not accurate, but there's an urgency quite often to, you know, and not, if there isn't an urgency, what there also isn't is, you know, the kind of capacity to wait, patience, right? Mm-hmm. It's not typical of high school seniors, patience. So I think it's kind of interesting. Were you aware that is somewhat unusual?
Yes, I think so. I was very lucky also in that I had a very unique and deep group of classmates that were my friends, and I think that cut across different groups and cliques that weren't all just the theater geeks, but there were some people in athletics and who were musicians and pre-business, but I think we all shared a sense of curiosity about the world and taking our time, and I think it also helped that my parents, not being in the arts and trying to also have me think practically a little bit, I think they were definitely encouraging me to tap the brakes a little and not.
I love these images.
Run off, you know.
I love these metaphors. What was the one you used before? Fire the gun, tap the brakes.
Yes.
Do you do a lot of that? Do you know? Are you aware?
I am aware of it. Sometimes I'm more aware of it than other times when actors point it out. I think it's fine. I find that it's something I do a lot as a director and as a teacher, because I think I've always been attracted to rich literature.
Literature. To language.
The language. And I'm not trying to, when I use it in the classroom or in the rehearsal room, I'm trying to use it to help the actor connect this moment to something in their own life, or something even another field, or something that's visceral, like a tapping the brake, something that they can use physically, kinesthetically in their body to imagine what that's like. And so I can always say, well, slow down, but there's only so many times you can say that. A metaphor is another way to actually let the actor hit the refresh button and go, oh, okay.
Hit the refresh button.
Well, yeah, there it is again. You know, but that allowing themselves to listen closer, because that's always something that directing and teaching is all about communication. It's in a way nothing but that. It rests on the responsibility and the honor of a teacher and director to encourage, empower, help their students and their cast to go to new places, consider new ways of looking at a moment in a play, and encouragement, empowerment, and allowing things to keep going deeper, and like being a great coach, I would imagine, for a team of athletes, to the coach is not the one on the field, I'm not the one up on stage, so but let's not settle, let's try to avoid being mediocre, and who knows what you've got inside you, and who knows where this could go if we really dig in. And that's something I think I found I always loved doing, even in high school and in college. I saw there were also better actors than me. I think I was okay, but when I looked around and saw the great actors around me, I loved helping them try to be even better. And I got so much satisfaction out of that.
Yeah, you weren't jealous of it.
No, and I felt like, I've assisted directors who I felt that there was some ambivalence about that. And if I was going to go down the road of directing, I wanted to feel like that's
the road.
That's the road. But having been an actor, and I think this is true of someone like Frank as well, who has also acted, mm-hmm. you can speak an actor's language, and the use of metaphor, or to talk to them about what their body's going through, or where they are emotionally, it's such a boon to be able to help break down any barriers of how we can speak each other's language, knowing that I think I know what they're going through, and sometimes knowing when to just let them alone and not take offense if the actor gets very quiet. And I can think, okay, I think they might be just processing my notes, so I'm not going to get freaked out by that. I'm just going to let them sit and
gestate. Well, they could be processing anything. They could be processing their own thing.
Yes, exactly. So it's about, sometimes it's about knowing when to give direction, sometimes it's knowing when to just shut up.
Well, I think we're getting a crash course in directing. And what's interesting, I mean, all of this is interesting to me. The thing about the language, I suspect it's just a natural way that you process information. That your brain is giving you these metaphors that are not routine. Mm. You know, people can have associations that are not common, not mine, not every, you know?
Sure.
Right. And I think you have a lot of those. You have a lot of those ways of seeing things that are not necessarily common.
Well, thank you.
Well, yeah, I think it's great. And I'm sure that it's effective.
And I think it also comes from my love of literature. I loved reading mm-hmm. from an early age, and I wonder if part of that is maybe my brain in some way is soaked up or collected.
Right.
That I am struck by when I read a wonderful turn of phrase. I went through a whole phase of John Updike, for instance, and reading, and John Cheever, and having grown up in Connecticut, you know, you kind of have to. That's required reading of the WASP curriculum. But I feel literally struck viscerally when, and I sometimes will even say out loud, even if I'm at a restaurant or a park or something, wow, by a great turn of phrase. And maybe there's something in that that stores that away, or thinks, well, it's somewhere in the closet in my head, and then I can pull that out, and I feel like that's something that I also, I don't just read for pleasure. I feel like in a way it's just, again, more grist for the mill, and it helps that I'm also attracted to heightened language plays. That's why the Aliens is interesting, because
before we get to the Aliens, right. And I do mean to get to it. Give me even just a snapshot of how you went from Northwestern to Sarasota.
Oh, sure. Well, in a nutshell, I stayed in Chicago for about 6 years. This is in the 90s. And I was directing and casting and working as an assistant to an artistic director. And then I was thinking probably heading to the East Coast when I got a job offer working at the Old Globe Theater in San Diego. Hmm. As the artistic associate there, like basically an associate artistic director. I didn't expect to go west and go to San Diego of all places, and I thought I might be there for a couple of years. I ended up staying for 7 years, directing, doing some teaching, helping their literary department get new plays and casting. And we went from 10 shows a year to 14 shows a year on three stages, which was really exciting. And I had other great mentors there. And then I moved up to Los Angeles in 2005 and went to grad school at UCLA for directing, and also worked for a company called LA Theater Works that does radio plays for NPR.
Yes, I know what they are.
Okay, yeah.
I've been there, actually.
Yeah, oh, great. So they, I was producing plays for them, directing and helping find plays and doing some of the national tours, actually, of their plays. They started doing that when I started there. Wow. And then I... starting about 2009, 2010, I was based in Los Angeles still, but freelance directing and also teaching. I've been teaching, actually, off and on since I was working at the Old Globe, both with the graduate students at USD, but also getting hired to teach and direct at places like Juilliard and University of Northern Colorado and UVA. And I loved that experience of being able to go back and forth between directing professionally with older actors typically, and then teaching on the heels of that with younger actors, because you have that great trade-off, that what younger actors may lack in some experience, they make up for in energy and commitment, and that kept me on my toes. And then this came about because I was had a break from directing. I'd just done Angels in America in North Carolina, and I was a little exhausted. Mm-hmm. And my uncle has a timeshare in Fort Myers, so I came to visit him. This is February of last year. And while I was visiting him, I decided to kind of tool around for a few days around Florida, went to Miami and had an interview there at University of Miami, and when it came up to Sarasota and met with folks at Florida Studio Theater and also with the folks at the Oslo and met Michael Donald Edwards and Greg. Well, I actually had re-met Michael because when I worked at the Globe, Michael actually came through as a director mm-hmm. at that point in his pre-Oslo days. So while I was interviewing with them, ostensibly to be considered as a guest director, I'd mentioned I'd heard that their second year acting teacher was leaving and they were looking for someone to replace her. And they confirmed that, and a short interview turned into a longer interview there on the spot, and there was further interviewing on the phone, and they offered me the job. And part of that job is directing one show out of the four a year. So this year it's The Aliens.
This would be a good time to talk about The Aliens.
Unlike some programs, Greg is open to small cast plays. I love that Greg has made that a priority, at least to some degree. Lobby Hero last year was four people. Aliens is three people. Because not only is it a different kind of muscle for the actors, but also it's reflective of many of the plays they will be cast in mm-hmm. once they get out of school. If they're only used to doing Shakespeare and the Inspector General and these and Once in a Lifetime, these massive shows.
And you can't take it with you.
And you can't take it with you, exactly, right. Which are wonderful.
Right.
But not every theater can afford to do that.
I was just going to say less and less.
Exactly. So we are preparing them to work in the real world. So we've got, mm-hmm. so this should be part of it.
Right.
So Greg had heard about The Aliens and he knew her other play, Circle Mirror Transformation. He loved The Aliens. He gave it to me back in the spring to read, and I loved it. I hadn't read anything quite like it in a very long time. And in fact, I read it a number of times back to back because I felt that it was it grew on me, and I wanted to. It kind of haunted me. Many plays I read, and I say, "Okay, I kind of get that," and I set it aside. But this one, I read it. I set it aside. I picked it up the next day. I kept thinking about it. I would talk to Greg about it, and we were saying how it kind of gets under your skin. It's on the surface. There are times in the play where the dialogue can seem kind of banal and everyday, but the more I sat with it, the more I saw how many layers are beneath that, and how rich the play could be.
And what a challenge to show it.
Exactly. And it also kind of scared me in a good way because
yeah, right.
I thought I tended to do more highly verbal plays with characters like that. Even Lobby Hero, even though that's a modern play, the characters there are very articulate. In fact, the main character is kind of a motor mouth. And that seemed very connected to my work with Tom Stoppard and Shaw and Shakespeare, whereas The Aliens, in some ways, is about these three young men who are not good friends with language. Language fails them. And it's not... to me, it's important to explore that it's not for a lack of feeling or a depth of thought. It's that there's a disconnect between what they're feeling and thinking and how they can express it. So, for instance, we joke in the rehearsal that there's a character, Evan, this high school junior, who's extremely awkward and has no friends, and suddenly is kind of taken under the wing by these two older, cool guys, though they're odd, too. But Evan, the high school junior's frequent expression is cool. Mm-hmm. But what we joke about is that cool is like ice to Eskimos or aloha in Hawaii.
Right.
There's 50 different shades of cool.
Right.
How do you, which cool is this? Is this cool in shock? Is this cool of, I want to go out and read that book right now?
Right.
And so that we're able to, what I call thin slice, these expressions that are like old pennies and we want to make them shine again. That we want to let, that we don't, and part of that is to hopefully invite the audience to let the play wash over them, put aside preconceptions, and I think that's one of the things that Annie Baker, the playwright, is playing with, is that these three characters, two of them are these kind of scruffy looking guys who look like stoners who you'd probably step around if you saw them at the Starbucks, and then the other one is the geek who's invisible to his classmates. They are aliens to their society, to most of us. And they are alienated from themselves and from us, and they are also aliens in the sense that people will often tend to avoid people who look like that and not think twice about them. And what happens if we put them under the spotlight? Because when we do, they reveal poetry and passion and
humanity.
And humanity and humor and hurt. And they deal with loss and new friendships in a way that's, I think, actually surprising and inspiring. But you have to look beyond the surface, and you have to look beyond the ums and the likes and the cools. But there's a poetry to it. We have spent a lot of time in rehearsal finding the music. Why is this an ellipse versus a dash? Why there's a character that says, but then, in capital letters, I remembered, period, something, period, your, period, mother told me after dinner that one time. So it's like David Mamet. It's like it's different how playwrights will write if you really look. You see, there is a method to this madness, and that is, if you give over to that, that is a kind of music. It's staccato and halting and fun once we see that it's there. And it's not, she's not trying to make it so naturalistic. She actually is letting it be theatrical, and I think the more the audience listens, the more they'll get the humor of how each of these characters talk and how each of them speaks their own brand of language, their dialect, I guess,
yes. In
a way. So it's a challenge. We're having an amazing time. I've also never done an all-male play before, mm-hmm. which is fun. And it's good to do a very new play. It's been a little while since I've
there's nobody's nobody's stage directions to copy.
Exactly.
really.
Exactly.
And so it's both a challenge because you have to find it, and very exciting because you can find it inside yourself.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think it's also allows a great contrast for the rest of the season because they've all just come off of doing Twelfth Night together as a class. They get to go right from classical to something super contemporary. Stopkiss after this is also contemporary with two great female leads. So now we get to switch the gender and let it have it be about the women and their friendship and what that develops from there. And the final play goes back to Shaw so that by the time they finish, everyone, the point of putting this season together that Greg asked for my help and Andre's help is to not just find good plays, but good plays for these particular group of actors and making sure that you spread the wealth around so that... So, for instance, the guys who were in The Aliens are not in Stop Kiss at all. Mm-hmm. So they get a break, they feel more rejuvenated, and it allows the whole ensemble to...
Yeah, it's
explore.
I mean, they're teaching. They're learning.
Yes.
This is all about the experience, right?
Which is different than setting up a season, let's say, for a theater like the Oslo. I think that's something that not everybody...
No, you're setting up a season for the actors.
Exactly.
Right.
It's all pedagogical. This is always, like you said, always about the teaching and not necessarily about box office and vision of a theater. I mean, Michael Edwards has clearly talked about an American
character
that he wants to explore. For us, the great thing is every year it's a different class, it's a different group of personalities, and Greg doesn't have to set this until the end of the first year. So we've spent a year almost with this group.
You know them,
right?
so you know what they need and
exactly.
what you ought to be giving them.
Yes, because this is not about serving to their strengths, it's about putting them out of their comfort zones to say, we cast you in this not so you can...
Shine,
but that you
so
can,
you can find this
exactly,
right.
And shine eventually,
right? To use this on the way to shine,
yes,
right.
And you know, use those muscles. Mm-hmm. We're Otherwise, why are you in school? Because
yeah, but you could do it. You shouldn't be
exactly.
And we shouldn't be
spoon feeding you.
Well, and we don't have anything to give you then.
Exactly.
If you have it, right? This is what your job is.
Yes.
Right.
And the other nice thing about these, the way that the plays are laid out, is that the point of this is to let them in their second year have great roles, play lead roles, and see what that feels like, and then switch gears in the third year, and then be put into a company where they still have good roles, but it's now not about carrying the play.
Right.
It's about working on that kind of professional echelon, and how do they fit in, and dealing with the rep schedule, and how intense that can be. So those are new. Each year, there's a different priority for...
Yeah, a different challenge.
Yes.
Right.
In the meantime, they're still working on classical work in my class, so we just finished a semester of Shakespeare, and now we're about to start on Shaw, Oscar Wilde, and in a new twist, I've never done this before, we're going to be finishing with Tom Stoppard's plays. So that I wanted to kind of take them over 100 years of great language and see how what you learn in Shakespeare and Shaw can still be applied to The Real Thing or Arcadia, or Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Okay, so I have one more question.
Yeah.
The question is, having given a life, and you have pretty much have given an entire life to the work, to theater, is there anything you would want to say about what that's like?
Thrilling, humbling. It's always a challenge. But it has, I think one of the things I'm most thankful for is the number and variety of great artists and great people that it's allowed me to spend time with. And I'm always learning. I'm always growing. And because of those great people, bumping up against them and spending time with them, I can't help but be changed every time one of those exchanges happens. So I feel really lucky and really blessed to have a life that allows for that.
In a way, it's like your very first experience that being in theater has allowed you to be with all different kinds of people.
Yeah.
Right? And it's like what happened in junior high.
Yes, exactly.
And
breaking down the barriers.
The barriers.
Yeah.
And allowing you to experience all of it.
Yeah. It's spend time in the theater. It means you are holding everything up to the light and looking at it in different angles and sharing that with the community. Wherever you're doing it, whether it's the community of Sarasota or wherever you find yourself, that and what I also love is how organic and evanescent the working in theater is. It's here today and gone tomorrow, and it leaves not a rack behind. It is there in the minds of the audience when they leave, and that's it. Like a great meal. You have to be there. There is no trace of it later. So to me, there's something very very profound about that. And to work in something where you are you know that what you're doing is in a way fading as you're making it.
Mm-hmm. It's the quintessential be here now.
Yes. Exactly. There's nothing else because you can't. you can't.
There is no end.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a great. So that's something I try to bring into my life as much as I can too, because you have to do it in the art. So.
That's great. Thank you very much, Brendan.
It was my pleasure.
So there you have it, Brendan Fox, being in the now, being very much where he is when he is there. That's, in a way, just another way of talking about being who you are. And if you were listening, I'm sure you could hear it in Brendan. The absolute certainty that what he's doing is what he is meant to do. That who he is and what he's doing are one in the same. and that experience of hearing that, it is my hope that it has inspired you, motivated you, not to make a New Year's resolution, at least not to make the kind of New Year's resolutions that we usually mean when we say New Year's resolutions, a list of things that you need to do or stop doing. No, perhaps this year you could resolve to discover yourself, to be yourself in this very moment, to honor the impulses which you usually deny, to trust the reflexes which sometimes you can capture but then you criticize yourself for. Perhaps you can ask yourself, if some of these resolutions, these things that you want to do differently or be differently, is it possible that there are ways in which you could just be more yourself and then you wouldn't have to try and be different? Well, of course, that's my message to you as the new year begins. And this is the new year, but we can begin again every day. Every day we can resolve to try and be ourselves, not to be manipulated by what others want us to be, think we should be, tell us to be, punish us if we're not. No. I'm not saying this is easy. I know it's not. But I believe so strongly that that is the way to contentment. That being willing to be who we really are and put that first, honor that first, is the way to happiness. Not that there aren't consequences to it. There are. And, of course, I talk about all of that in my book. So, as we are running out of time in this year, I want to thank, as I always do, every week and all the time, Josh Hackney, who is who he really is. And part of who he really is a very talented IT guy, someone who just knows why things have gone wrong when they have gone wrong. And if he doesn't actually know it, he knows how to go looking for it. It's so wonderful to watch. But I need it desperately, and if you need it, you should go to the Lynn Show website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, and say, I want Josh. And, of course, you can say, I want Lynn as well, if you want. I am wishing you a very sweet evening and the beginning of your happiest year. And as always, I hope you got something from this show, something that will bring you back, because I will be back in the new year. Next week, same time, same station. And as always, I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. That I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flag, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, Phil, but I still got some tang.